Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Diane Shelton, and she will be speaking on tattling. So let's listen in on Diane.
I'm an early childhood teacher from Mankato, Minnesota, early childhood special education, and then I also teach at the college level at Mankato State University in curriculum instruction and special education. So I get to kind of see the whole spectrum. And I would like this to be informal and interactive because we all have our own personal experiences with tattling. But I'm going to start a little bit with my position and how I got there. First of all, kind of the broad perspective I have is that we're in trouble. I mean, our country's in trouble, big trouble. And one of the major areas of the big trouble is the violence. How children treat children at a very young age. We're seeing higher numbers of adolescent violent crime now than ever in history. I work with young children from birth, primarily to age like 8, 7, and I've been doing that for about 20 years, and I've seen in my own life a big change in families, how they interact with children, how the children in families that have great difficulties in communicating in a healthy way learn to interact with children outside of their homes. Child abuse reports are up dramatically. Tremendous amount of violence in the home, which we all know about, and what happens with that? How does that translate out? Well, I think it's extremely disturbing, like most people. And on one hand, I think, well, what can we really do about it? You know, it seems like it's gone to such great lengths that some of us say we're doomed. Right, Don? You're not the only one. I've heard that many times in the last couple days. And we say it tongue-in-cheek sometimes, but really it's overwhelming and frightening. So I guess my thinking is that who I can affect and what I can affect is what happens with me on a day-to-day basis in the greatest way. And that might mean one child at a time. One of the reasons I think that we're at such a huge, a contributing factor, I should say, state of violence, is that number one, children don't have a primary adult in their lives oftentimes that they can tell important things to. And another piece of that is, oftentimes when children tell us what's important to them at a particular age and stage and time, we don't respect it. So what I think we do is basically systematically condition children not to tell us things. We start when they're very young. And they come to us and they've hurt themselves and we say, you're all right. Okay? And on one hand, we don't want them to, you know, we're so afraid that they're not going to be tough or be able to handle life for whatever reason we have. For maybe it's just trying to be positive about the experience and get them redirected to something else. But what then very quickly happens by the time they're 3, for sure, is they're trying to figure out, they're not only coming to us to show us things that have happened to them and tell us about them and wanting us to value that, they're beginning to try and figure out what are the rules of society. I hear you telling me that I can't hit someone, that that's not okay. And yet, when you're not around and someone hits me, and I come and tell you that, you don't respond. Or you don't help me. Okay? Tattling to a kindergarten teacher is one of the biggest banes of their existence oftentimes. And after I talk about this, inevitably a kindergarten teacher will come up to me and say, but you can have 25 of them telling you the same thing, you know, coming and telling you things all at once. No. But what I've discovered is that when we listen to children from the time they're young and take them seriously and respect them and respect what's happened to them, the tattling decreases. It's almost amazing. And I've taught kindergarten teachers some of the strategies that I'll talk about in a minute. And they come back and tell me, you know, we have lots of telling for a month. And then when I act on what they tell me and talk to them about their concerns, by Christmas time it's all over. They're solving things by themselves. Not because the teacher is saying go away, but because she's taught them strategies of how to deal with their conflicts. And that's a major point. One of the things that we know in our lives is that we have a real hard time with conflict. I don't know. Y'all have that down? Y'all know how to do that? Well, one of the reasons it's so hard for us as adults is because we didn't get models. No one came with us and said, well, you know, let me show you what works for me. And that's what I'm suggesting, is that when children come to us with a significant issue, and remember, it's always at a particular developmental age and stage. Oftentimes the mistake we make is we respond to them from very much an adult thinking level, rather than saying, this is a four-year-old coming to me, and this is a very significant four-year-old problem. Let me give you an example that will make you quake in your shoes here. I taught for many years in a self-contained special ed classroom right next door to the kindergarten rooms. That was kind of before we got into inclusion. We were close, but you know, not quite all together. And one day I walked in to ask a particular kindergarten teacher for some paper or paint or something. And I saw this little girl standing next to the door just crying in the most devastating way. You know, the sobs that are just racking her little five-year-old body. And the teacher's over here just kind of going about her thinking. I'm thinking, well, maybe she's not aware. The whole room's doing things, and you know how kindergarten rooms are. You know. So I said, excuse me, Mrs. D, are you aware of Susie over here by the door? Yes, I'm aware of her. She's wet her pants, and she can just sit in them until it's time to go home. Well, Susie had told her what her problem was. But this kindergarten teacher had definite ideas about what was expected and what she would do with a child's needs at that particular age. I'll never forget that child. And that child will never forget that incident. That's part of the conditioning. Why would I ever go to an adult when that's the response I'm going to get? Now, we know all adults would never do that. But how many does it take? How many times do you come in from recess to tell your teacher about what happened out on the playground, and that teacher says, I'm not dealing with it, that's the playground supervisor's job, before you start telling what happens on the playground? And I'll give you another illustration of that. My son came home this year. He was in sixth grade. And kind of talking about things that happened at lunch. I just kind of talk about the day. And he says, oh, Mom, you never guess, we got the flame out this far today. The flame? The flame? The flame from what? And it was from Hot Shot, you know, or the stuff you use in your mouth, and somebody lights a match, and the flame goes out, and here a bunch of sixth grade boys behind the bushes. And the big issue became, do we tell? What do we do with this information? Because by sixth grade, it's already dangerous to tell. because there will be retaliation. I mean, he's with his buddies. They've all learned the same deal. There's no benefit in telling. So, what I'm suggesting is to say yes to tattling. That we switch that around. And we look at it in a more developmental kind of way. What do we know about tattling? It happens primarily 3, 4, 5, 6, second grade, pretty high. And then it starts declining. Now, I don't know whether that's because they've learned by that time not to tell, or they're actually moving into a different cognitive level, and so they're able to figure out things, and they're moving into a little different moral level, so they're able to figure out things on their own. But until that time, children need a tremendous amount of guidance, and what we know is that they're in very much the law and order stage of moral development. Right and wrong. It's either right or it's wrong. And if you tell me, if you're the one that's providing the rules, and you tell me that it's wrong, and I'm getting those rules, and I hear that this is a consequence, then I want to make sure that that follows through. Oftentimes it's the girls that do the tattling, because oftentimes they're at a little higher verbal stage than boys in those younger years. Okay, any thoughts or comments about what I'm saying so far? Does it fit? Yes? No?
It seems to me that with our human nature that what you're saying is good to a point, but then there are children that also learn that they can get other children in trouble like that.
Well, I think that becomes then our responsibility to read those cues. In other classes I've talked about is reading those cues. And if that, it's probably more, I want my teacher's attention and this is how I figured out how to get it. And so if we name why that child's approaching us or continues to do that, oftentimes then we can address what's really happening. You know, I think a child comes up and tells repeatedly and repeatedly, and you try some strategies like, well, tell me what you do. I'm glad you know what's expected. And those are some strategies that I like to use a lot.
So affirming their telling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you bet. Affirming, but also not getting into them wanting you to become a part of something that's, you know, I mean, and then we're going to talk about some ways to become an active part of some of those circumstances too. So I guess in those circumstances, I always try and look at what is the behavioral cue I'm getting. Is this child really wanting to get other children in trouble, or does this child have some other needs? Sometimes it takes children longer to figure out what the rules are.
Yeah. I like that because it's taken on an individual basis, and it leads me to think, do you state it to the whole class, you know, hey, tattling's okay, come to me, or do you just deal with it as it happens?
Mm-hmm. One of the things I believe in very strongly is naming. And by saying to the whole class, I think, you know, that's tends to be what I do, and if I were a first grade teacher, I certainly would, or a kindergarten teacher. And the way I would do that is to say things, and you can do this in your families too. I want you to be safe. And I want you to learn how to interact with each other so you are safe. When things happen to you that hurt you, or that you think I should know about, I want you to come and tell me, and then we'll work on it together. And that's the crux. I'm not just saying, come and report. And I'm going to respond to that. I'm saying that we as adults need to go much deeper and further. This is our opportunity. We're opening up for children. Come and tell us. Then it's our opportunity to act, to become the model, to demonstrate ways of talking to each other to solve conflicts. That's the working part. And that's the opportunity that we have to start changing interactions and violence. We've ignored it from the time they are so young. Typically, this is what happens. Think about your own family. Think about your own experience. Two siblings are fighting in another room. One of them gets hurt eventually. Maybe they're playing, it goes to fighting. One of them comes and tells you, and I don't know, most of our responses are something like, go solve it yourself. You know, go deal with it yourself. Or, I've told you 100 times not to fight. Some way, we're not going to move or leave what we're doing. The same thing happens on the playground. Now, was there a model that happened there? Was there any conflict resolution? No. Same thing happens at school. That happened on the playground. Go tell him or her not to hit you anymore. I mean, sometimes we go that far. But then what happens in translation? The child goes out to the room where they've been fighting. Mom's told me to tell you to stop it. Oh yeah, great. That'll just stop it right there, won't it? Same thing happens on the playground. So what we become is very annoyed with children coming to tell us things. Because you know what? What do we have to do?
It interrupts.
It's like, go away. I don't want to deal with this. And teachers say, we've got to get on with the business of school. And I maintain that is the business of school, and that's one of the main pieces of school, is helping our society learn how to get along together. So, a child of 4 is out on the playground, comes to me and says, in tears, Susie hit me with a stick. I'm going to say, because I've talked to the class, haven't I? We're going to solve it together. That means everyone knows that I'm going to be an involved person in solving the conflict. So I will take Billy's hand over to Susie, and I'm going to give Billy the words to talk to Susie. I'm not going to do it for him. I'm going to say, Billy, tell Susie, it hurt me when you hit me with a stick. And then I'm going to stop and wait for a response from Susie. And what do you think we usually hear then? We hear another part, okay? And her part might be, well, he took my stick from me, or he took something from me, or he hit me first. Okay, then she's responded, and I can say, Susie, next time he takes something from you, you can say, give that back to me, or you can come and get help from me. I'm your helper in this. And in the conversation, I might keep giving children the words until there's some resolution. Now, these are very young children, remember, but that's the point. How old is your daughter?
4.5.
Perfect for her.
She's right in there.
She's right in there. And I start doing it with 2-year-olds. The school that I work with at, there's a toddler daycare room, and there are about 20 children in there at a time with a variety of staff. And all the staff now know this sort of technique. And so you have staff taking seriously what children are coming to you with and then helping them solve the problem. And in that case, it might just simply be labeling or parallel talking, some expectations. But I would say the critical years for follow-through are 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, until they reach, until they're kind of moving out of the, they're moving into more abstract thinking at that point. But those are the years where we need to be giving them models and words.
And let them express their feelings, I think. I know for Claire that's so important. be understood that it hurts her feelings or that she doesn't like them.
And we use those words a lot too. A child comes to us and says, Billy said he didn't want to play with me. And how do you, you know, and the child says, that makes me sad. Because what we've been doing is labeling feelings too for children. So they understand, they've got some labels already. So I will then take the child who's sad over to the friend, and I will say to this child, to Mark, say, Mark, tell Linda, I'm sad that you don't want to play with me. And then oftentimes what we will get at that point when children come and they've got the words and they label, is that the child who doesn't want to play with them has a rationale. And they'll explain, well, I don't want to play with you now, but I'll play with you later. Right now I'm playing with songs, and that's all it takes. But what have they learned? They've learned so much. The child who is able to go directly to the person and label how they feel. One of the things that happens is that when we don't do these kinds of things and we systematically teach children not to tell us things that are important to them, is that they certainly grow up and don't tell us some very major, major things. Not all children. I happen to have a child whose conscience or whatever, every night, if there's something that he thinks I should know, he can't go to sleep unless he tells me. But not all children are like that, right? And they become more distant, and they stop telling us more and bigger things. In our community in Mankato, not too long ago, a teenager jumped off and killed herself. Actually, she did it in Minneapolis. Young student, I think she's just probably just got out of high school, I don't know, it was around that age, 18, 19, jumped off a building, killed herself. She had told several of her friends, and when the parents went to the friends and said, why didn't you tell us? I mean, they knew. She had told them very clearly what she was going to do, and in enough time to get help, and they let her do it. And they said, well, why? Well, we didn't know if anybody would believe us. And also, we thought it would be betraying her. But she had a right to that. So, there are grave consequences for not teaching children words to use to help solve conflicts and to, in more than anything, it's that trust. It's coming to us with what's of concern to them and taking it seriously, then going back and helping them with a model so that they have a blueprint. Now people say, well, you know, can't be doing this forever. No. And the wonderful thing is, when we teach the model, very quickly, children don't need us to come with them to solve their conflicts. They start doing it themselves in very appropriate ways. I've worked with children with a variety of handicapping conditions. And one of the things that this approach does is that it helps children not be victims. Again, if we talk about people who have been sexually abused in their childhood, what we hear often is, I was afraid to tell. And often, as adults, people who have had experiences earlier in their life don't want to tell still because of the reactions they'll get from people. And they're legitimate. So what we want to do is teach children not to be victims. Okay, that's a huge piece of this. And so oftentimes, like I said, I work with children with handicapping conditions, but think of children who are slow to warm up. They might be children who we call shy. You know them, you went to school with them. Sometimes kids picked on them a lot. what I teach those children in this way is they come and they tell me, Mary called me a baby. Oftentimes children will call children with handicapping conditions babies. They don't have categories to put them in. So I worked with one little girl who had Apert syndrome. I don't know if you're aware of what that is, but it's the child would have very dysmorphic features, very gross. Their faces, very not aligned, large eyes, very obvious. So what I needed to teach that child was very clear to me was to not be a victim, to stand up for herself. And I worked with her for about 3 years at the daycare center where she was now included, and by the end, no one called her a baby. Because what I taught her to say when she would come to me and say, so-and-so called me a baby, I'd take her by the hand, we'd go back, and I'd say, Violet, tell her I'm not a baby. So you're going to give children not only those words to solve conflicts in a neutral kind of way, but you're going to give children words with intonation to stand up for themselves. Any comments about that? Nikki, do you have any comments? You said, I'm coming to this one on tap.
I was thinking of a situation where at the daycare, at Woman's Home, she has three daughters, and one of them is probably one and a half, and Claire was about three, and she kept pulling her hair, and she'd come home and tell us every day, tattling really was starting, you know. And Tom sort of has been worked with her on the tattling thing. That's one of the reasons I'm really interested, because we don't really agree all the time. He was differentiating between tattling that is just for meanness and tattling that really you need some help. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure she can really figure that out, yeah. So I'm interested in hearing about that. But he taught her, and he really was helpful in every time she would reach out to pull her hair, the little girl, Claire, could reach up and push it away. That was one of the things that she could try, and it really worked. I mean, that just, like you said, just ended it right there. Just giving her a technique to do really worked.
But he did the most important thing. He listened to her, and he then gave her some problem-solving strategies at that point. And that's the mistake we usually make, is that we don't listen, we push them away. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought up the abstract.
Or go tell the mom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was an alternative at the end, too. But.
Yeah. Yeah. And the wonderful thing is we all have different strategies. So the more people that are involved in modeling, the more models the children have when they grow up. They're getting a couple of things. They're getting models and strategies. They're getting words to tell how they feel. And it's happening in real life. And that's the critical piece. When we've done research on social skills, we can do little social skill groups till the cows come home. And the reality is they don't transfer. Children don't take that information and put it to use on the playground. But if we're there involved, it does, because it's real life, it's meaningful, which ties into your point, and that's where children are in terms of their understanding of abstract thought. Third grade classroom I walked into, there was a big sign, you know those signs with the red slashes through them, smoking. Well, hers was tattling. And my child was in that room. And I said, well, tell me about your philosophy of tattling. Excuse me. And she said, well, I let them come and tell me things if it has hurt them or someone else, physically, she was talking about. I thought, whoa, that's a tough one. That's a real tough one, isn't it? Hers were quite concrete in terms of physical injury, which totally wipes out any emotional injury that happens. And we know that that's some of the major stuff that happens in elementary schools. We still in this room can remember painful experiences. There's one that just flies into my mind. But oftentimes what teachers will do is come up with a whole list of things that children have to think through before they can tell us what's happened to them. Now, I don't know about you, but I think it's real, even as an adult, to always know, when do I tell? Is this legitimate? What will happen? What will be the backlash if I tell this? I'm not going to put myself in that position. You know, there's lots of things we think through. It's very abstract. It's like the whole sorry issue that some of us talked about the other day. That children, you know, we force children to say they're sorry when it's kind of the flip of that. Yeah. You going to say something?
No, I'm just figuring it out.
So we say, well, we want to know the important things. Well, the important things don't come to us, you know, we say, I mean, they're adult important things again. They're not important to, I mean, they're different, they have different levels of importance for younger children. Like, you know, developmentally, we can just about go through. I'll tell you that at about age 3 and 4, one of the most important things that children are telling us about are their fears. At about age 7, some of the most important things that children are telling us about are their relationships with peers and how they feel and how they fit in. And that's such a... And one of the reasons we shut them off is because it's like... they're having a friend problem every other day, or they have a new friend every other day. Well, that's their stage. As they get into high school, I work with 7th graders, they're fearful about the new environment they're in. They're fearful about just a lot of really, concrete things. Are they going to make it to their locker on time? And we can joke about that stuff, and I mean, you know, we will, and that's okay to do it in fun, but to not totally turn them off and to tune in. And I think it becomes harder and harder as a parent to know, when do I get involved with what a child comes home and tells me? When do I step in? And one of the things that I remember that a professor told me in college that has helped me a lot is that one of our jobs as parents is to protect our children. And there's a huge list of people that we need to protect our children from. And what I think that means is that we need to listen to our children. And on that list are teachers, grandparents, brothers and sisters, spouses sometimes. I mean, basically what it comes down to, our job is to protect our children from any kind of danger. And to be able to do that, we need to have listened to them, developed a relationship of helping, and being there to demonstrate conflict resolution.
Sometimes the conflict is within the child. For example, I think, he hurt my feelings when what he really did was not want to do what I wanted to do.
And that's, but still to name that and then go with the child, and at least he can label that. You can't solve it for him. I mean, that's what this is about, you know, is demonstrating and modeling. And the other child might just look at them, which they very often do, and say, I don't want to play with you right now. And then our next step is, Sammy says he doesn't want to play right now. I wonder what we can do. We move into some action. Let's see. And what I've done with children in that circumstance that I think is so helpful is we might go around the room and ask 5 or 6 other children to play before we hit one that wants to play. And what then I label that and talk about it. Sometimes we have to ask lots of friends to play before we find one who wants to do what we want to do right now. Or maybe this is an okay time to play by yourself. But so you come in again, you can't solve or make those feelings go away. The feelings are fine, but we can take that opportunity to teach them some approaches, some problem-solving approaches, if we take it seriously. If we want, really what I think it comes down to is time, effort, energy. If we're going out on the playground to help intercede, it means we have to get out of our nice, comfortable desk chair or the couch. Okay, we have to be interrupted. But my question is, what's more important? In the long run, we are seeing what happens when people don't take an active part in teaching social interactions. Does that make sense to you, what I said? Mm-hmm. About taking that information and mm-hmm. and going further?
What about paddling among adults? Do you think we need to set up the same ground rules and deal with that in the same way?
Don't adults want anonymity, and then they're more than willing to do it.
I think those are some of the biggest moral dilemmas that I face as an adult involve, what do I do with this information?
I'm a pastor in a multi-staff situation. I recently went to a workshop by Rabbi Friedman, and he wrote books on generation, different mm-hmm. things. Family system stuff. And we were dealing with, if you have a parishioner that comes to one pastor and tells them about the other pastor, does the one pastor then, should they tell the other pastor, you know, what's going on and stuff? And Freeman says yes. Mm-hmm. That you should, to avoid being triangled.
Mm-hmm. You guys are a team. Okay. Yeah. And to be a team, you have to communicate well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that by coming to one pastor, the individual who is telling whatever the perceived fact is probably trying for anonymity.
Sure.
You know, they're not going to face the individual themselves.
Well, and it's exactly what I'm talking about with children, is that we're also used to not having anything done. Okay, well, I'm going to come in and tell you about Joe over here. You deal with it.
Yeah.
Not, you know, it's off my chest, you know. But if your response was, well, let's just walk over and talk to Joe. And letting people know, this is the way it's going to be. I mean, that's one of the great things about tattling as adults, I think. What it's where gossip starts. I mean, it's the whole, there it is. I don't have to deal with you. I'll just tell somebody else. But if we as adults take the role of director, communicator, problem solver, and name it right off.
Sure.
If you're gonna tell me something, and I just put it right on the table, I'm involving him.
Or maybe just to say, hey, you know, why don't you go tell them directly?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Avoid getting that triangle. Right?
Absolutely. And you know, it happens at work where I work all the time. People will come and tell me something about someone else. And my response is very much like it would be with a child, only of course I'm not going to get into the problem solving directly with the other person, but I'll say, for instance, Jerry might come to me and tell me something that had happened between she and Jean. You know, this is not just typical. And I'll say, you know, in my relationship with Jean, I know that when I tell her things directly, we can solve the problem. I think she'd be real interested in your response and directing them immediately to that other person. Have you read some of the stuff out on gossiping? The latest stuff on gossiping? That gossiping, if for instance, we're talking about Don here, and I say, did you hear about Don last night? You know, he is really wild. I don't know about him. He's kind of strange, don't you think? Kind of some of his ideas. And if Linda says, I really like Don, I think he's a neat person, boom, gossip stops. That first response back determines whether the gossip is going to continue. That's what the studies are showing us. However, if Linda says, yeah, I don't know, I had this experience with him, then you two are probably going to continue the
thing. I think what's interesting too is that say you come to me and I say, I defend him, or I say, I think otherwise, you're not gonna seek me out, you're gonna seek out somebody else. You know, thinking about churches and coming from a church that just split, essentially.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I guess it's really typical, too, but that was kind of what happened was the groups became really separate, and some we were fairly new to the church, came in. People were really feeling us out for a long time, and they'd say things. And if we defend, it was the pastors in this case, co-pastors, you know, we were never talked to again. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think it's, you know, deeper than someone stopping to gossip. They're going to go elsewhere in certain situations.
But at least you're not a part of it,
exactly.
And you haven't continued.
Yeah, that's important.
And I think that that's at least a place to start. And what I've discovered with some gossip at my work is that it finally will kind of wind its way if people start. And also, I think, you know, it's kind of interesting if you make a stand and other people hear that, and they heard your stand, their opinion of Don is different than, I mean, you've stopped fought for people, whatever. Then you wonder again, it's like you brought up with children, you know, what's the intent? Yeah. And oftentimes with gossip, we know the intent is, I don't feel really good about myself, so I'm going to talk about this. Of course, they're not able to name that, but I'm going to talk about this person to help myself feel better, to get those sides formed.
Yeah. And I don't know how broad to take this, but is it possible, you know, to be talking about another person in a constructive manner, and whether that, you know, gets into the tattling issue or not, or do you always have to include the person that you are talking about, do they always have to be involved in the process, or is it possible to somehow be constructive without the person?
Well, you know, it was really interesting because I was talking about Don the other day. And it was in a really positive way.
That's really interesting.
You know, I said to somebody, have you met Jill's husband, Don? You know, I just think he's really fun to talk to, and, you know. And I didn't feel like in that instance that I needed to...
But I'm talking about negatives.
Oh, negatives.
In a constructive way.
I have to explain how that can be.
If someone's behavior is very damaging to a community, let's say...
Mm-hmm.
And several, let's just bring two people.
Mm-hmm.
I feel more comfortable with two rather than a group.
Sure.
And two people, you know, are saying, yeah, you know, this person also, you know, is affecting me in a very negative way and stuff. And just having the support of the other person reaffirms, you know, that, yeah, you know, it is me, or it somehow will enable those two people maybe to develop a strategy for dealing with it, without blowing it out of proportion, mm-hmm. and not talking vindictively about the person, mm-hmm. but just this behavior, you know, affects me and is negative and stuff. And if they were to go to that person, and I'm talking very abstractly, but
no.
Perhaps that
this
that
is person, where it gets to. This yeah. is. I think this is exactly what I'm talking about. Just let me do a little advertisement here that we started talking about in the beginning is it's human relation. How do we relate to another person? What do we do when that person hurts our feelings as adults? What do we do when we run into someone that causes me internal conflict as an adult? You know, what do we do with that?
Sure.
I think that's exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
And if you would include, you know, the person whose behavior is abusive or just obnoxious or whatever, that wouldn't improve the situation. You know, that in some instances it might make it worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds almost like what you're talking about is a reality check. I mean, it's not really dealing with the situation, but it's talking with somebody else saying, boy, you know, this is how I'm feeling about this, and this is how I'm feeling about that person. Does that make sense or whatever?
Sure, yeah.
And that might be a step toward then deciding to go and actually.
Yeah, and you may decide not to.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's a step toward figuring out a strategy, right?
Yeah, right. So. And so is that gossip or is that tattling, you know?
Sounds like constructive conversation.
Yeah, I lead a group of computer system managers, and so there's some people who are real cerebral, and everybody has their strengths.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of years ago, I found myself defending one of the members of the group who was real obnoxious. When I first started doing it, I was defending him because I didn't want to join in to attacking him behind his back, essentially. I was uncomfortable in that position at first, and then I started doing workarounds. You know, I'd say, well, look, on that level, you know, you don't have to deal with that person. You can go to Joe. He'll help you do the same thing. And you got to remember that what this guy's really good at is when, and you know how you sit there and try to learn to do this one thing? Just pass the job to him. He loves to do it. He'll take the job and do it. He may not be real nice about it, but he'll give you the answers back. And then you'll have time to do something else. And you just, you know, you have to do that, keep a work group going and keep all the productivity up.
And you're talking about what I just put up here, a plan for action. I think when it's the same premise.
Right, but you never involve the person.
No. So you're saying, okay, maybe you and your pastor, and this happens with myself and my colleagues all the time too. We might have, for instance, I worked with a parent last year who was very, very, very angry at me because I turned her in for child abuse, very legitimately. And so she spent the year kind of making my life a living hell every chance she had. And I did kind of the same thing you're talking about. I very, in confidence, and that's a piece, talked with another colleague about, you know, this is what I'm facing with this parent. These are the realities. What can you brainstorm with me some ideas? Now you came up with those on your own. Others of us sometimes need other people to come up with that. As long as I think, you know, I guess this is my own opinion, everybody has their own, but my opinion would be as long as it's done in confidence and it has a constructive end, there's a plan. What you did was model some incredibly appropriate strategies for your coworkers.
But we used to sit around, I mean, I joined in this too. People, as he was leaving, he finally left. After a number of years, he worked there a long time and went off to another company to a real big position, good promotion. And I mean, I remember as he was leaving, people were saying, I wonder if he has any idea how everybody feels about him. Mm-hmm. You know, and chances are he acted like he didn't.
Mm-hmm. But that's that part, you know, we've talked a lot about exclusion at Holden the last few days. And, you know, that's, I think people do know. I think it's painful. And he probably didn't learn the strategies as a young child of how to respond. No one gave him the model and the words. Just like other people in that group didn't have the words to approach him and say, you know, it makes me feel like this when you do this. But you know, just on a one-on-one level.
If, you know, you think of it, if probably if he was approached, I don't know how he's doing now because he moved to another state to his job, but if he was approached by the appropriate person, which is typically not a coworker.
Right.
If he was approached by the appropriate person, he may have had a better time later on.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for all of us.
But then how do you work that out?
I mean,
I work at a company that has an ethics hotline.
Yeah.
It's about the only anonymous thing we've got.
Yeah.
And
that's interesting.
Yeah.
A tattling hotline. Hotline for tattling right here. And what do we do with it?
We don't really know whether anything happens. I mean, you know, and we're very circumspect about using it. But
the thing is, problems are going to get solved. Mm-hmm. People are going to move away. Relationships become covert, undercurrent, all sorts of things. Well, what kinds of relationships do we want? What kinds of relationships do we want our children to work in and be a part of? You know, a lot of this, and one of the first things that I didn't talk about a lot today, is naming. I mean, we have to start, for heaven's sakes, naming some realities. Mike did that last night in his sermon. Did y'all hear his sermon last night?
Yeah.
Were you there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was excellent.
Wasn't it excellent?
A lot of people were made uncomfortable by it at the beginning, at least.
He named some realities.
Yeah.
And he put out on the table some things that people had been talking about in a covert kind of way, probably in a destructive kind of way, really. He put it out there. You couldn't ignore it anymore. And so that's a huge part of it.
But he's also leaving today, right?
Yeah.
But he's also on the board of directors.
Yeah, he is an associate.
It wasn't
just a parting shot.
I'm going to tell him you said
that.
Dante. Yeah, it was really well written. I was blown away by his ability to do that.
To bring up some really major issues and name them and put them out there.
And make it funny.
And that's the thing, too, is that as soon as I come to you and say, I have something I need to talk to you about, and you really listen to me, it dissipates.
Isn't that one of the most uncomfortable things, though, at first, that somebody ever can say to you?
Oh, my gosh. And then, like we've talked about in other sessions, you don't want to just talk to anyone. I mean, you're going to be careful. And children do that too. We don't expect children. I think that's one of the things as they grow older, who they tell about important events in their lives becomes a very small group of people. I know it is for myself and for most people because you want to trust them. And there are a few people in our lives that we trust. Does this make sense? Have you thought about tattling in quite these same...
I haven't thought about it too much. I just know that it's there, and I just kind of... It's not a subject that comes up much. People don't talk about it.
It doesn't come up, but boy, it doesn't be fibrous.
Spouse.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The behavior comes up quite a bit. The label, I haven't used that label in a long time.
Mm-hmm. No.
Is there another word for it?
Well...
Yeah,
it's really negative.
Oh, yeah. It's a very negative.
Well, but that's the word that children get, right. And that's why I use
tattle
it.
Tattle.
Don't tattle. You're a tattletale. One of the things I wanted to also go back to just emphasize is that when you run into someone, a parishioner, a friend, a spouse, a child, who needs to tell so much, tattling, just like whining, just like any other behavior, can simply be a flag for that person that they need something else and they don't know how to ask for what they need. And that's another great opportunity for you to say, to name it. You know, you've been telling me many things that have been happening with your brother. I'm hearing a lot of really negative things. Do you need more attention from me? Or you brainstorm and talk to them about some possibilities of things they might need. Do you need just some undivided conversation time? Because we all will develop behaviors to get what we need. And if tattling works, I'm going to do it again and again. If whining works, I'm going to do it again and again. If screaming and crying works, or being silent, whatever the strategy, we'll do it again and again.
So then you need, if the child, for example, we'll go back to children, mm-hmm. if they need the attention, there's something that they need, then you need to get them to get it in some other way.
In an appropriate way. So you give them the words. You say, and I do this all the time with children. In fact, I have been living with Lucy. You all know Lucy? She's the little girl with the screech that could break glass at this point. And we've been working the last few days, labeling things for her. So that even though she can't say the words, she's 17 months. She can't say the words, so what is she doing? She's screaming. The way she's getting what she needs and wants is by a high-pitched scream that mom or another human being cannot ignore, right? So we say, and it's amazing. It's been fun to watch. She wants her mom's attention, so she screams, and I say, Lucy, say mom! And she can't say mom. So she'll say mom, and then mom gives her attention. What has she learned? I use the word, I get what I want in an appropriate way. So what we're basically doing when we go with children and teach them strategies is we're showing them the power of the language, consequences. I get something. If I use the appropriate words, I get what I want. Is there a greater motivator? I don't think so. If I walk up and I can say, I want a double hot fudge sundae, and that is there, that's powerful. So we're teaching people appropriate ways to get what they want so they don't have to fight with each other. They don't have to beat each other over the head. They've now got words.
So in other words, every once in a while, we have to make sure they get what they want.
Well, we need to...
I mean, there has to be, you know, some type of reward in there.
Right.
Rather than...
But there will be. Yeah. There naturally is. It's amazing that when we ask directly for what we want... Now, not always do we get what we want. That's clear. But it is amazing if I say to my children... You know, I might be in a really crabby mood, for instance, and I want to be left alone. And I might have lots of behaviors that indicate that. But it's amazing that if I say, you know, I'm really tired and I need 1 hour to myself to sleep. And I don't want to be interrupted during that hour. At 10 and 12, they can understand that. And I can get what I need and want in an appropriate way. My mother used to be a screamer. It took me a while in life to realize I could use words with a normal tone of voice and get what I needed and wanted in a much more pleasant way than screaming and yelling, which of course alienates people. So a lot of it's figuring out what is this child or this person approaching me need? You know, maybe your spouse is, think about the person you live with. Are you all married? You all have a partner? I mean, I'm not at this point, but someone you live with. It doesn't have to be a partner, because I live with children. That's what I think about. They've all developed ways If you think about the people in your life for about 2 seconds, you can think of the ways that they get what they need or want in pretty unhealthy ways. Can you think of circumstances? We need to quit here in 1 minute. You don't have to say them out loud, but think about how it might feel that at a time when they're not angry or upset or needing something desperately, that we say to them, next time you're feeling, I'll use myself, sometimes when I feel really nervous about something, I revert to the yelling or the barking at my children. When I, you know, when we're at our worst and we revert, and and my children have done this, they'd come up to me and say, you know, if you say that in another way, I'll help you. Or, you know, it's easier to help you. But if we give them, you know, it seems to me what you need is a hug when you're kind of losing it. All you need to do is ask me. Tell me, I need a hug now. That's powerful.